university and college campuses in the United States are in charge of curriculum. That's what the Constitution, the faculty constitution, lays out, that we're in charge of the curriculum. There isn't so much a direct challenge to that as indirect. And that happens in a number of ways. You mentioned hiring. For sure, we've seen a trend in the administration away from hiring long-term and tenure-line positions in favor of shorter contract workers whose connection to our classrooms, our students, our departments is much thinner and contingent, which makes all kinds of challenges for delivering the kind of education that students deserve and are paying more and more for.
These contract people also are paid very, very poorly, right? A couple thousand dollars a course. Some of them may teach at various schools all over the area, right? They have huge transportation expenses. And furthermore, they don't spend much time at any school.
Sure. You're really describing the situation facing a group of faculty called adjunct, usually called adjunct faculty, who are hired just about by the course as sort of piece workers.
Uh-huh.
AUP represents full-time faculty, but the full-time faculty who are not tenure line, which are an increasing percentage of our full-time staff, have similar instability issues. They don't know if they're going to be hired the next year. They do work at a much lower wages and teach a higher course load because that's how their contracts are written. So again, the overall health of the curriculum, the overall accountability of faculty to students becomes compromised when such an important part of our faculty is faced with these very poor working conditions. And that's a big part of what educator-led education means, that we all have the conditions of stability and academic freedom and professionalism to really give students value for what they're, again, increasingly going over in debt to achieve their education.
Full-time faculty can work together on building sort of an integrated curriculum, on talking about students and developing a culture of learning and achievement amongst students, whereas people who are there for a year or two and then try and go on to something else, they necessarily, and are paid extremely poorly, can't really be part of that process. And there's also the question of sort of institutional memory. When people are just floating in and out, you don't have a department any longer. You just have a bunch of courses being taught.
I think the faculty at Portland State at every level has worked heroically in the past 6-8 years during the recession to really try to protect the quality of education that we're giving our students. And we have grown the campus. We have continued to distinguish our curriculum, you know, in U.S. World and News reports and other areas. Our feeling at AAUP is this faculty has done a great job. And that's what's so confusing about the administration's seeming unhearing posture toward us in bargaining. We have delivered under very difficult circumstances, and we seek to protect our contract provisions that help support our work. Hence the outpouring of enthusiasm for a potential strike, not so much for striking itself, but that we have to send a strong message that we don't understand why we've been working so hard and doing so well, why our 35-year-old contract is being so deeply challenged by this administration. Something doesn't add up. And so that's why we're in the situation that we're in right now.
I guess I should make a admission. My partner worked at PSU for some 25 years as a faculty member, now an emerita, is retired. I met a lot of faculty at PSU. Really, there are people, just lots of people, not only who have academic achievements and publish a lot and the rest of it, they're committed to teaching. And in fact, it's those departments, the people I met there in the liberal arts, those departments are now being savaged, is I guess being saying too much, but they're being cut and cut in favor of departments that maybe can raise money through scientific grants and research. So, and business, engineering, computer science, even economics, although economics is getting savaged as well in favor of business, just without. It seems to me that also it's happening across the United States. This is not just PSU. Mm-hmm. The sort of idea that we have to serve business and produce workers who businesses want to hire instantly because they have the skills, that's really antithetical to the idea of a of a university that teaches kids how to think, their history, the foundations of society. It's a very different view, and it seems to me real threatening and terrible of what the administrators are now doing across the country. This is not PSU alone. PSU is actually stands out maybe as better than,
right.
than many.
I mean, again, this is what's so confusing about this round of negotiations is that what's distinguished our curriculum is it's very engaged and community-minded thrust. And our capstones, our community-based learning, our university studies curriculum. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the sciences sort of have it over the humanities, although I think you're right, the humanities have certainly been a little bit more embattled during this recession and some of the neoliberal nostrums that are being peddled mostly by, I think, technology companies looking for a piece of the higher ed market. But the turning point for me in all of this, the turning point for me is a moment really two moments that came together in the fall. One was a student who came into my office to say that she said, Patricia, I cannot afford to stay in school and I cannot afford to graduate. So what the student is saying is she's in an economically untenable position. And my job description has been rewritten, right? I used my job description formerly was help students to get the skills and the perspective and the broad learning they need to navigate a very uncertain present. But my job description has been rewritten. And now I feel like I'm really a vector for debt. And the parallel moment here that the student who can't afford to graduate and can't afford to stay in school is paralleled in the faculty. Because I have faculty members, colleagues who come up to me and say, Patricia, I can't afford to take my sabbatical. Right, they can't afford to stay current, pursue new scholarship, to bring that to their students, to stay cutting edge, to give their best in the classroom. They can't afford to take their sabbatical because that does involve a bit of a pay cut. But of course, they can't afford not to take their sabbaticals because if they don't take their sabbatical, they can't get promoted, they can't get a raise, they can't advance professionally. So that is also an untenable situation. And I think the upsurge within AAUP is an effort to draw attention, to the administration's attention, to this moment in which students and faculty are not adequately supported to do the work they want to do, and indeed that they must do in the way that you describe. The way to navigate this uncertain economic climate is to have students who are prepared for lifelong learning, to have students with a broad perspective that involves, again, university studies, historical perspective, broad humanistic modes of learning, as well as skill-based and technological learning. But what's new here is that we have students and faculty and academic professionals coming together on our campus to defend the work we want to do, the work we're committed to doing, and indeed the work we must do if we are to steer this generation and ourselves through the current difficulties, economic difficulties that are around us.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Patricia Schechter, who teaches history at PSU and is a member of the AAUP. That's their labor union, the American Association of University Professors.
99 years old, going strong.
They're in a great contract fight, and it's about really the future of the university, the extent to which the university serves student needs for a broad education versus the extent to which it serves industrial and business needs for willing and able workers. Patricia, the debt crisis, of course, for students now, and of course all universities in the United States except for the ones with the hugest and largest endowments are cooperating actually with U.S. banks. Student debt now is greater than credit card debt in the United States. That's a shocking thing. It's unbelievable, actually. It's shocking so many kids are so deeply in debt, and therefore they have to make choices about how they're going to work, who they're going to work for. They're so deeply in debt that they're so insecure, they can't really marry, they can't have families.
Yeah.
It's like...
Here's how I think about it, Bill. I used to think, you know, when I was growing up, the sort of ethos was you needed to go to college to get a credit card. Now, you need a credit card to go to college. And this speaks to the kind of shameless quality, frankly, of the credit card and banking industry. that without scruples, they are willing to saddle young people with debt that they cannot shed and that will change their life, as you point out, will change their lives. Again, I think the reason why this is such a powerful moment at Portland State is because our students have known this for years, and they have been mobilizing and organizing around student debt for years. And what makes AAUP and the students come together so powerfully is that our union president, Mary King, who's a labor economist, has, in fact, enfolded, and other members of AAUP and other faculty have enfolded the study of debt, particularly student debt, into their coursework. It's PSU students led by faculty who are leading our union, who have gone to Salem to propose legislation for debt relief, the Pay It One, the Pay It Forward proposal, that the pilot of which I believe passed in the last session. So we have a very powerful moment in which students and faculty come together to say no more, that we need a different formula. We need a student-centered and academically focused budget and priorities that really serve the students that, again, faculty are here to mentor, to educate, and to move forward with.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. And students also, like Portland Public High School students who came to support their teachers so strongly, walking out of 7 of 10 high schools, half the students.
It's incredible. I mean, during our strike vote, there were posters plastered, beautiful, bright, cheerful red posters plastered all over Smith Center. And they said the following. They said, "Professors strike, students have your back."
Yeah, that really
is
great.
It's amazing. Yeah. I always say this to students, it's an honor to teach. It's an honor to read student work. And that is the power of the moment we're in.
And the students recognize they don't want to go to a trade school. They actually want to learn now. Now that the business is taking over all schools, students are beginning to realize what it means for them, that they're trying to make people into very specialized kinds of workers rather than citizens.
Well, and I think, too, many of our students, and I also think a myth is, I'll just venture this, I can't prove it, I think many of our faculty are first time graduates from college or people in their families who are pursuing higher ed for the first time. And for them, for me, for us, academic freedom is real. To be able to ask the uncomfortable questions is precious and energizing and important and essential. And so they get that a public university like our public libraries, like other spaces of freedom and inquiry, are worth defending.
One final word that I'm sure you agree with, part of course, of the struggle for the university. University presidents are under immense pressure to raise money and to stay alive, and they do anything possible to do it. And they do it because the support for education in the United States is falling, and what the support it is trade schools rather than real universities. It seems to me that all students and teachers and citizens, they're in a struggle about how the national wealth is going to be deployed. And as long as the tax policy is to favor the wealthy, and as long as wealth is deployed for the defense establishment that's greater than the next 30 countries combined, it seems to me education is always going to be imperiled. I mean, this is a struggle not just for the schools. It's a struggle in many ways for the country.
Yeah. I mean, what I hang on to is this notion that I think gets wide appreciation in our community and beyond, which is the notion that education is a sort of K through life proposition, that in order to stay a vibrant and creative society, in order to have an engaged democracy, in order to have a public and civic culture that's an artistic culture that's meaningful, that's robust, that's honest, we need a long view. We need to take the long view of learning. That gives me hope. That gives me hope in the face of, you know, very concentrated powers, as you mentioned, in industry and other sectors. Because I think there's a sort of common sense and a kind of historical wisdom to the notion that human beings are always growing and always changing and need nourishment, need challenging, need resources in order to realize the fullness of their potential. So when I feel bleak and I feel beleaguered, I often touch back on these very tested and common sense values that we're living longer, we are a growing country, we're a growing community, and we need to make sure we have the resources and supports in place that are going to help us realize the fullness of our humanity and the fullness of our potential together.
Patricia Schechter, PSU History Department activist in the AAUP, the Professional Union, Professors Union, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure.
Your houses they pull down, stand up now, stand up now. Your houses they pull down, stand up now. Your houses they pull down to fright your men in town. But the gentry must come down and the poor shall wear the crown. Stand up now, diggers all. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was an excerpt from a 17th century song written by the Diggers and sung by Chumbawamba called Just the Diggers Song. I'm playing excerpts of it because of the conversation that we heard on More Talk Radio just in the previous hour. Before Chumbawamba, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Patricia Schechter about the strikes that are looming at Portland State University and the real political and social stakes that are involved in that. Up next, I'm going to be talking with Peter Frace of Jacobin Magazine about the demand for working less every week and where that comes from and really where we might start to go if we were to realize that. This Thursday, April 3rd at 7 p.m., there's going to be a Workers' Rights Board meeting where you can come and hear a number of panelists, State Senator Michael Dembro, another State Senator, Avil Gordley, Pastor David Wheeler, and State Representative Jennifer Williamson respond to testimony from PSU students, faculty, and staff. It is going to be in support of the teachers' union. Up next now, I turn to talking with Peter Frace. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined here by Peter Frace. He is an editor of Jacobin Magazine and sometimes comes on the Old Mole to talk about unconventional ways of problematizing work. And today we're going to talk about the renewed popularity around the idea of a shortened work week. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
That's great to be back once again, Joe.
So last week I talked with Anna Coote, who works for a London-based think tank called New Economics Foundations about reducing the work week to 30 hours. And why don't we start with you talking about where the demand for the shorter work week really comes from?
I mean, where it comes from, I mean, there's a couple different levels to that. It comes historically from, you know, the demand for shorter hours was, for much of the history of labor struggle under capitalism, the sort of central demand, you know. That was, you know, the 10-hour day at first and then the 8-hour day, you know, was like central to the building of the labor movement both in the United States and in other early industrializing countries. And it was that, even more so than wages, was the thing that a lot of labor struggle was built around. And it was only really after probably about World War II, that wages and benefits, that sort of thing, came to be seen as more central than hours, and the sort of 40-hour work week or something like that came to be taken for granted as just the norm rather than something that workers really fought over. And then I think now, in the context of the Great Recession after 2008, in the context of a situation in which we still have very high levels of unemployment, some people are trying to bring the conversation back to saying, well, maybe one of the ways we could deal with that instead of just thinking about how to create more jobs, is also thinking about how to share out work in a more sensible way by reducing the number of hours that people have to work.
You have a pretty, not quite as wide of a of an advocacy basis, say basic income, but you have labor historians and leftists like Gar-Al Porowitz arguing for that. But you also, I think, have a kind of more center-right sense of that especially is tied to the notion that, you know, we're losing a work ethic, and so making sure that everyone can work is a way of morally redisciplining the country.
Well, and I think it's worth saying, too, that that's true. It comes from the right, but it also comes from the left. I mean, there's a debate that goes on the left, and I've had this debate with a comrade of mine, the editor at Check of the Magazine, Steph Ackerman, about this idea of shorter hours as being superior to things like basic income, precisely in the sense that it poses the issue as an even reduction of work for everybody rather than dividing the work, dividing the population between those that are dependent, you know, are forced into wage labor and those that are able to survive outside of it. And that's obviously related to an old debate among both liberals and leftists about the way in which, you know, it's very bad for advocates of labor and of the welfare state when you get into a situation where the recipients of labor market regulation or of government programs are perceived to be as some kind of a small parasitic minority, which is dependent upon, you know, the people who work, right? And it's racialized in the context of welfare reform and takes all kinds of different forms. But I think that's one of the things that drives people to think that, well, maybe if we could just, like, reduce working hours across the board, that might be the most, you know, the thing that's most conducive to solidarity, to a sort of like a solidarity developing way of going forward with stuff.
Yeah, it's funny how it gets pitched in terms of, you know, there being the assumption of work and we're just going to somehow try to mitigate that, rather than saying that we want a world where if people are working, they're doing it because they want to. And we probably also take for granted that there's going to be a lot of just a desire to continue participating in things.
Well, right. And it's so hard when you're in a situation where people need to get access to wage labor in order to survive. It's so hard to raise questions about whether that work should exist. Somebody gets paid to clean the bathrooms at Goldman Sachs. And even if you don't think there's any reason for Goldman Sachs as an institution to exist, getting rid of it still costs that person a job who is not some kind of slimy, rich banker, you know. And so as long as you can, if you don't create that space for people to live outside of wage labor, it's very hard to address those questions.
So what is exactly, when say Keynes, you know, imagine that we would be working only 15 hours a week, or the Wobblies even, you know, saying a 4-hour day, or Anna Coot in the New Economics Foundation publication, 21 hours, arguing for 21 hours. You know, how are we supposed to think about what is happening in as much as we accept the wage relation, or in as much as we accept some kind of socially imposed work society?
There's a way in which the shorter hours debate, it doesn't get all the way at the sort of contesting the existence of wage labor or the existence of certain kinds of wage labor. But it does at least get at this question of, given that capitalism is this two-sided process which exploits workers and it despoils the environment, but then at the same time it creates this, you know, massive levels of material productivity. And so then the question is, who is going to benefit from that? Is it going to be the workers, or is it going to be the 1%? Up to the heyday and through the time of Keynes, the way that that question was understood was as much about freeing up time as it was about taking a share of material goods or money or income. And in a certain way, that is the way it becomes a kind of a post-work project, in that sense that as we become a materially richer and richer society, that doesn't just have to mean, you know, you get a raise and you can buy a bigger TV. It can mean you can work less and have more time to spend on life, on all of life outside of work. That is, to me, the kind of deep political point about shorter hours and the thing that those of us on the kind of labor left who are raising these questions are trying to get back to.
That's the point I want to draw attention to is, you know, we're not working or we're working less, and so we are doing more, and we're calling the doing more life. And there's a lot of people out there who see a lot of what we take for granted as our own free time that we cultivate according to our own subjective and personal desires as, you know, really part of keeping us productive members of society. And for a lot of people, free time is actually kind of illusion. And so when does that free time actually become ours?
That's a tough question, and I'm not sure that I really have a good answer to it. I mean, I think in terms of the way that it's talked about by economists, it gets to a fundamental problem that mainstream economists at least have in discussing any question having to do with the labor market, which is that they perceive things and they represent things as individual choices that are really collective political choices or outcomes of political struggle. And so that the balance between how much time we spend working for wages versus how much time we dedicate to the rest of life, if you want to create a world in which it's possible to actually make that decision to work less, that requires collective struggle, and that's something that, you know, the mainstream economic theoretical toolkit is really just not equipped to grapple with.
One of the outcomes of advocates of a 30-hour or otherwise reduced work week is that it would free up more time, more labor time to be given to people and bolster full employment. And you've written about full employment before. Can we talk a bit about what you think full employment means and what some people try and make it mean, but it doesn't really mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an important thing to understand. And it's a thing that, you know, when you say full employment, I think to somebody who doesn't study economics or isn't immersed in kind of technical policy debates about this stuff, full employment sounds like, well, that just means more jobs and more work, right? And that seems intuitively correct, given that we are clearly in a situation where there are a lot of people that would like jobs because they're broke and they're unemployed. And we'd rather be in a situation where the unemployment rate is, you know, 3% and not 8% or whatever. But as a technical matter, full employment is just the balance of supply and demand in the labor market. It means that where you bring the supply of people that are trying to get jobs for wages as close as possible to the demand of employers for those jobs and thereby bring down the unemployment rate. And the farther down you bring it, the more you increase the bargaining power of the workers, whether that be the power to demand increased wages, better working conditions, or shorter hours, or whatever. And so thought of that way, it's not really inconsistent with the kind of post-work project of trying to reduce the aggregate amount of wage labor that's being performed or critique the existence of some of the wage labor that exists. It's about changing the balance of power in the labor market, which is a very different question. But I think partly just because of the language of the demand itself, you know, and the phrase full employment, and also just because of the kind of assumptions that are baked into a lot of our political conversations in this country, a lot of people don't grasp that.
One assumption is that we need to increase job opportunities to get women out of the workforce. And I know that you have worked with Kathy Weeks, and I'm wondering what other kinds of work are there out there that people are also contesting how much they put into, not just paid wage labor, and how that fits into making an effective kind of movement for reduced work overall.
This is a really important point, and it's why the thing that makes Kathy Weeks' book, The Problem with Work, such an important sort of statement of the of post-work politics today is that it explicitly frames it as a feminist project and connects it to the project of pointing out all the ways in which our society and capitalist society is supported by and reproduced by all kinds of unwaged labor, which is disproportionately done by women. And traditionally, of course, that's, you know, when people talk about that, they're talking about labor of raising children or caring for elders or cooking and cleaning at home. All the stuff that made it possible to have this sort of ideal of the single male breadwinner family in which the man went out and earned wages and the woman stayed home and did the rest of the work. And what has happened is that women have gone into the workforce. Women have done increasing amounts of wage labor while still shouldering most of the burden of unwaged work. And so the demand for work reduction is not just a demand for the reduction in paid hours, although that's important. It's also a demand to recognize that that is not the limit of socially necessary work. That's not the limit of the work we're doing. And in its more modern forms, you have people talking about the labor that happens on social media, on Facebook, or on Twitter. There's all kinds of, I think, newer ways in which people are understanding the way in which work time goes beyond waged time.
And that brings me back to the point I was raising earlier about when the work that we are doing for our time meets or is differed from our free time, and how there's so much more, they call it immaterial labor, happening out there that we don't get paid for, that just supports the accumulation of capital for others. And how are we supposed to take that into account when we are trying to target work as a social ill, as an excess?
And that's a tough question, Joe. I mean, it's a really tough question, and I don't completely know the answer to it. I mean, yeah, it's true that to a certain way of thinking, it's work can come to encompass almost everything, especially when you're in a kind of work that doesn't have a workplace that's fully defined. I mean, I conceive of the conversation that I'm having with you right now as work in the sense that it increases the chance that someone will ask me to write something, or somebody will ask me on their show, or raise my visibility and raise my, you know, probability of getting paid for something else sometime in the future. And I think that's all true. And it's important to bring all that stuff up. At the same time, I don't think necessarily, you know, to our advantage to always conceive of everything that way. The real question ultimately is, what are your other options? Can you opt out of it? And that is just a very material economic question of what is the alternative to doing both the wage and unwage work that we're doing. And that's where things, not just shorter hours, but like the basic income that we've talked about before, become important, is creating that baseline where you can make real choices about the work that you're doing if you have the ability to opt out of it.
Well, I think that is all the time we have for today. I've been talking with Peter Frace. He is an editor of Jacobin Magazine and sometimes comes on the Old Mole to talk about the changing realities around work. Thanks for joining us again, Peter.
Always great to be here, Joe.
The gentry are all round. Stand up now, stand up now. The gentry are all round. Stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, stand up now. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise. The devil in them lies, and hath blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, stand up now.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. We just were hearing another clip from Chumbawamba's English Rebel Song album, and the track was Digger's Song. Before that, I was talking with Peter Frace about reducing the work week. Up next, we are going to be hearing another book review by our book mole, Larry Bolden. He is talking this time about Patricia Lively's new memoir called Dancing Fish and Ammonites.
Good morning. Today I want to talk to you about an amazing writer who's been as important to me as any I can think of. Her name is Penelope Lively, and I'm going to be talking about her brand new book, Dancing Fish and Ammonites, which she says, quote, is not quite a memoir. Rather, it's the view from old age, close quote. Lively is now 80 years old, and judging from this not quite memoir, she's still going very strong indeed. Lively won the Booker Prize for Moon Tiger, published in 1997, and she's written many other novels, collections of short stories, poetry, children's books, and scholarly essays. Her latest books, like all or almost all of her earlier work, is focused on memory and time. Lively's first intellectual interest was in archaeology, an interest she never lost. She read history at Oxford, married an academic, and has continued to read history, fiction, science, and pretty much whatever she could lay her hands on. She was born in Cairo in 1933 and remained there until she went to England on a troop ship in 1945. Perhaps because I, too, am what Lively would call at the portal of old age, I find her essays on aging and memory fascinating. A lot of the reading I have done lately by or about growing old has been quite depressing, focusing primarily on what is lost as we age. Lively is well aware of the diminishment that aging can and inevitably will bring, but she manages to focus on what is left rather than what is lost. She has certainly had her share of infirmities that come with age. Quoting again, I avoid occasionally, I fear, that hazard light worn by the old, slow, potentially boring, hard-going. Now that I wear the light myself, I am nicely aware of the status. This is a different place, and since I am there, along with plenty of my friends, the expedient thing seems to be to examine it and report. We are many today in the Western world, the new demographic. I want to look at the implications of that, at the condition, at how it has been perceived, and then at the compelling matter of memory, the vapor trail without which we are undone, close quote. Lively sees herself primarily as a reader. Although she realizes that not all readers are or become writers, For her, reading became writing. This almost memoir would be worth reading by a devoted reader simply for the long list of books she mentions while describing her own journey as a reader. I decided long ago, near the very beginning of my teaching career, that what I needed most, both for myself and for my students, was to read and read, and to do so in what Lively calls a mostly undirected, unstructured reading. Reading only philosophy and directing all my writing energy to writing esoteric journal articles seemed to me to shortchange both myself and my students. Quoting again from Lively, "Must read. For me, reading is the essential palliative, the daily fix. Old reading, revisiting, but new reading too, lots of it. Reading in all directions, plenty of fiction, history, and archaeology always. Reading to satisfy perennial tastes, reading sideways too. Try her, try him, try that. Reading in old age is doing for me what it has always done. It frees me from the closet of my own mind. The one entirely benign, mind-altering drug. My point here is to do with the needs of old age. There is what you can't do, there is what you no longer want to do, and there is what has become of central importance. I have reading." In this little collection of essays on memory, gardening, writing, and history, Lively takes her readers on a historical journey of the past 80 or so years. The Suez Canal crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the new wave of feminism. For me, interest in the past segued into an interest in the operation of memory, she says, which turned into subject matter for fiction. I wanted to write novels that would explore the ways in which memory works and what it can do to people. Close quote. As she certainly does, and she certainly does just this, from the aging scholar heroine Claudia, living out her last days in a nursing home in Moon Tiger, to a landscape archaeologist and a gardener in The Photograph, to the World War II veteran who becomes an architect in City of the Mind, and her own memoir of her childhood in Cairo, Oleander Jacaranda, A Childhood Perceived, Lively pursues her interest in the operations of memory. Her own scholarly research into psychological tracks on memory shows up in much of her writing. As she has her character say again and again in her stories, it's all happening at once, as past, present, and projected future fuse into one for the lived life of each person. Many years ago, Moon Tiger was the first of her novels that I happened to pick up. A brother and a sister at the seashore fighting over an ammonite that both claim to have discovered, and that launched me into the world of ruminating about time and memory with Lively. Quote, "That is why history should be taught in school, to all children, as much of it as possible. If you have no sense of the past, no access to the historical narrative, you are afloat, untethered. You cannot see yourself as part of the narrative. You cannot place yourself within a context. You will not have an understanding of time and respect for memory and its subtle victory over the remorselessness of time." Close quote. It would be easy to write pages and pages simply of quotes from this remarkable little book. It is a testament to a reader's life well lived. Hopefully those who read it will be driven to read some of her novels or simply to copy out the long list of books she mentions as part of her own vast reading past. And quoting once more from Lively, "What we have read makes us what we are, quite as much as what we have experienced and where we have been and who we have known. To read is to experience. I can measure out my life in books. They stand along the way like signposts. My old age fear is not being able to read, the worst deprivation, or no longer having my books around me, the familiar, eclectic, explanatory assemblage that hitches me to the wide world, that has freed me from the prison of myself, that has helped me to think and to write." Close quote. Bravo and carry on. I've been talking about Penelope Lively's sort of memoir, Dancing Fish and Ammonites. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are now going to wrap up the show with a discussion between Jan Hocken and Grace Sylvia, who are here to talk about the Rethinking Psychiatry Film Festival coming this next month.
Welcome to KBOO, Grace Sylvia. Thanks so much. Hi, Jan.
Hi. So you have a film festival coming up, and we'll be talking about the selections and the importance of the festival itself around mental health organizing. But let's start with the organization and what does have to be rethought about psychiatry.
That's a great question. We're an activist organization that is trying to shift the system away from pathologizing, which is there's something wrong with you and we can fix it with these drugs, to lots of ways to being in the world, to honoring lots of ways. And maybe there's not even anything wrong with you. Maybe it's a spiritual emergence you're going through, or maybe you just have a wider or deeper ability to feel, or a heightened ability to be creative. Or maybe if there is something wrong, it's not something wrong with you. Maybe there's something wrong with society. Maybe we are living in a crazy-making society that's harsh and unjust and cruel, and maybe there's something wrong with that, and we're having a natural, normal, reasonable even reaction to that. Or maybe it's a reasonable response to trauma, and maybe it's the trauma from society, maybe it's individual trauma. And then maybe if it's that, maybe we don't need to fix anything but honor or explore it or mentor people in how to be in the world in a safer way with their, as some people call it, dangerous gifts, or work with the trauma and use the so-called symptoms as actual guidelines, guideposts to the healing. And then if meds are used, then they should be used as a last line of defense. There's so many other alternatives out there that have been shown to be way more effective than slamming people right at the first with high doses of very intense, strong psychoactive drugs.
So the rethinking is in one sense rethinking the idea that's been quite heavily sold, that people with particularly symptoms of distress that get labeled as a disease or disorder, or maybe that just some forms of distress that can be understood, even interpreted differently,
yes,
rather than through the medical model.
Yes.
And of course, you, I'm sure, come up against the criticism that are groups like Rethinking Psychiatry just anti-medical model? Is that a dangerous and seductive proposition for people who do suffer symptoms identified as psychotic? Are they led into a false promise of alternatives that may make them more ill? How do you respond, just briefly, to those critiques? And then we'll talk about how the film festival works as a kind,
sure,
of site for exploring alternatives.
Sure, thanks. We would actually counter that the big pharmaceutical industries have offered a false promise that these drugs are the silver bullet for everything that ails people. And in fact, Rethinking Psychiatry started as a result of Robert Whittaker coming to town to talk about his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which is an amazing book that goes through the history of how the different psychoactive drugs came into being. And he looks at all the research and goes back and actually reads the research. He was a medical journalist and finds that even their own research doesn't prove what they then have used it to supposedly show.
So some of these alternatives are being explored through film and film culture. Tell us about the festival, and I understand the videos for the first night, April 2nd, Wednesday, April 2nd, are videos that are close to your own heart around the Soteria movement that you've also participated in. Tell us about those videos and what's about what Soteria is. The first night is called Films Beyond Soteria, an intriguing title for sure.
So the Soteria model is that people having first or second psychotic break could come into a place and be with other people who would just honor where they are and be with them. They were big on being with. And the idea was that social relationships and honoring where people were at and letting them go through it was very healing, was deeply healing. And in fact, it was the original Soteria House was a 12-year research project by Lauren Mosier through the National Institute of Mental Health and was very effective. They used low or no dose psych drugs and have amazing stories of people working through their psychotic episodes. So there's a replication project up in Alaska, and there's one in process trying to start in Vermont. The challenge with the one in Alaska, I actually was very curious about Soteria House. I read everything I could find. There's a fabulous book about it. But I couldn't quite get it in real life. How does it work? So I decided to call them up and say, hi, I want to come up to Alaska. And they said, sure, okay, you could work on call here. So I went for 2 months in summer 2 years ago. The challenge was that the original model is for people who have not been on psychiatric drugs at all or very short time.
So the films on April 2nd have this aim of also building support locally.
Yes,
a house.
And the reason that we call it Beyond Soteria is because so many people now have been on drugs for so long, we're trying to come up with a house that could address that. And there is a project that is trying to happen right now through Rethinking Psychiatry and the Moms Movement. And they, in fact, the Moms Movement and Mind Freedom are co-sponsoring these films. There'll be some short films, an interview with the guy who's trying to start it in Vermont, and maybe some other alternatives out there.
And the Moms Movement are mothers of young people who've been treated in traditional psychiatric hospital settings and are looking for alternatives.
Exactly.
And so we'll before we close today, talk about some of the events, the ongoing activity of Rethinking Psychiatry that meets at the Unitarian Church several times a month, right?
Well, once a month
we
have
open meetings.
A regular open meeting with some kind of fascinating speaker or other kinds of events. We're also doing...
Let's talk about, before we close, we'll let our listeners know about how they can get involved on an ongoing basis.
Can I just kind of give you the layout of the film festival?
Yes.
It's going to be for the 5 weeks of April. We're alternating the first week Wednesday, so that'll be this Wednesday, y'all. The next week, it'll be Friday, April 11th, and then alternating between Wednesdays and Fridays. And should I tell about the different films?
Well, how do you pick the films? The people can come for free, make a contribution at the door.
Exactly.
So these are very hospitable, accessible social space at
We're
the Unitarian
suggesting
Church.
$5 to $15, but nobody is turned away for lack of funds. So please come.
So how did you choose these films?
Rethinking Psychiatry knows we can't make this change in our mental health paradigm alone, so we really work on collaborating and working with other organizations. So we mostly are partnership driven. We look for other organizations and then we say, so what film is near and dear to your heart?
So that really advances the activist focus that goes
yes.
beyond the films and certainly beyond a kind of consumer spectator approach to film
yes.
and one more participatory. So, yes, tell us about the other films. On April 11th, there's a film on foster youth.
Yes, it's called Short Term 12, and it's that night is co-sponsored with the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, which is an amazing group of young adults who've been through the foster care system and are now doing policy work, amazing policy work. And they chose this film, and it looks really powerful. On Wednesday, April 16th, it's a film called The Hidden Enemy. It's co-sponsored with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights of Oregon, and that film is about veterans and active military and psychiatry. The film Friday, April 25th, is co-sponsored with some of the radical peer groups in town, the Icarus Project, Light of Madness, and Portland Hearing Voices.
And it's called Dialogues with Mad Women.
Dialogues with Mad Women. That one I have seen, and it's powerful. It's seven women talk about their experiences, and it's quite extraordinary. And then the final film is Wednesday, April 30th. It's called Guilty Except for Insanity, and it's made with a brilliant local filmmaker.
It's ringing a bell.
We couldn't pass up Dr. Jan Hacken. We are so excited that we're going to get to have you talk about your film and share with the audience and answer questions directly.
Well, I think for those of us who are involved in media activism, whether it's radio or film, this is really important to be part of a broader social movement, which is different than the kind of auteur, famous, you know, the director-driven approach to film. That
yes.
Films are community or group expressions of creativity, and also can be important in activist projects. So. In closing, just say a bit about first how people can learn about the film festival through your website.
Yes, please.
And then about a bit about monthly, what's happening with upcoming monthly meetings.
Okay, so please, y'all, come visit us at www.rethinkingpsychiatry.org. It's pretty easy to get there, and there you could learn about our upcoming symposium in May. We'll have a two-day symposium with a national speaker and workshops by local activists. And we also have monthly meetings with fabulous speakers the third Wednesday of every month at the Unitarian Church. That's free. We, of course, pass the hat, but it's totally free. And our film festival starting this Wednesday.
Yeah, it should be very, very exciting. Well, this is Jan Hacken with Grace Sylvia talking today about Rethinking Psychiatry and the upcoming film festival that begins this Wednesday, April 2nd, Unitarian Church at 7 p.m. Thanks so much, Grace.
Thanks so much for having me, Jan. See you all there.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank Jan and Grace Sylvia for coming on to talk about the Rethinking Psychiatry Film Festival. Bill Resnick and his guest Patricia Schecketer, who was on to talk about the PSU Teachers Union strikes and the fight for an educator-led education, higher education system. Also thanks to Larry Bolden for his book review of Patricia Lively's Dancing Fish and Ammonites, and for Peter Frace of Jacobin Magazine, who came on to talk with me about reducing the work week. You can find this show and segments of it on the Old Mole website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be on next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. Up next, we will be hearing from... Cascadia is off, actually. Instead, we'll be hearing an excerpt from the series Between the Lines with topics not heard on mainstream media. This KABU program that we just heard, the Old Mole Variety Hour, was made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater. Featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KABU Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the JHS Annual Multicultural Film Festival's presentation of Two Americans. This documentary considers the status of undocumented immigrants in light of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil rights violations. This showing of Two Americans will be facilitated by Mr. Freddy Trujillo, who will lead the discussion following the movie. Two Americans will be shown at the North Portland Neighborhood Library at 512 North Killingsworth, on Tuesday, April 8th, starting at 6 p.m. More information on this event can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up, Air Cascadia is off, as Joe just told you, and we will hear an excerpt from the series Between the Lines. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Elise Higley, campaign director for the Family Farms Measure, about the growing community of organic farmers in Southern Oregon who are banding together to stop the proliferation of genetically modified crops. And at 11, we honor the birthday of farm worker and labor leader Cesar Chavez by broadcasting Fight of the Eagle, a documentary on the United Farm Workers Union. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now we will go to Between the Lines.
When President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, on December 31, 2011, civil liberties advocates were alarmed at several provisions within the legislation, including Section 1021 that empowers current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. A lawsuit challenging this measure was filed on January 13, 2012, on behalf of seven plaintiffs contesting the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions of the NDAA. The plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and MIT linguist, Noam Chomsky. On September 12, 2012, U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a permanent injunction that barred the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention to U.S. citizens. But the Obama administration appealed that decision to the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which on July 17, 2013, overturned Judge Forrest's permanent injunction, declaring that the plaintiffs lacked legal standing to challenge the indefinite detention powers specified in the NDAA. On December 16, 2013, the plaintiffs appealed their case to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they hope to overturn congressional support of presidential powers to indefinitely detain suspected terrorists. Your reporter spoke with journalist and author Chris Hedges, who provides an update on his case and talks about the urgency of restoring civil liberties lost since the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
I had spent 20 years overseas as a foreign correspondent, most of them with the New York Times. I was in frequent contact with groups that are on the State Department terrorism list or individuals who are members of those groups, including al-Qaeda. And I had covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. And during that time, this was during the Reagan administration, the anger towards the press, we were exposing government atrocities. When I got to El Salvador in 1983, the government-backed death squads were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month, wholesale massacres of Salvadoran peasants. And because we were exposing these atrocities, we were attacked as being fifth columnists, as being members of the guerrillas, as et cetera, being sympathetic to the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And there was no distinction between us and the groups that we reported upon. And certainly I think that if the NDAA or if Section 1021 of the NDAA had been in effect at that time, they could have easily used it to criminalize the role of a free press, which is essentially to provide to all sides, all groups, even those that are hostile to the United States, a platform by which their views can be heard. So it wasn't academic to me. I think that the government, when it has that ability, you know, and what is substantially support? What are associated forces? No one knows. Now, it gives the government a great deal of leeway in terms of interpretation. And one of the things that they did in the appeal is the government lawyers kept saying that independent journalists, that was the word they used, had nothing to fear. Well, who is it who determines who is independent? And what happens when the government decides you're not independent? for whatever reason. And certainly when I covered the war in El Salvador, you know, Ollie North and Poindexter and these figures within the Reagan administration did not consider us, quote unquote, independent.
We all just have to remember, with the recent passing of Nelson Mandela, that the ANC was designated as a terrorist group. So many of the organizations and individuals who supported the ANC in their struggle against apartheid in South Africa would have been deemed fellow travelers of terrorists and potentially imprisoned without access to attorneys, charges, or trial, just like we're seeing post 9/11. Is that right?
Of course. You know, I used to work with the PLO when it was deemed a terrorist group. Oftentimes these groups, which are liberation movements in the eyes of some and terrorist movements in the eyes of others, become your chief negotiating partners, as Arafat did and as, of course, Nelson Mandela did. So, you know, I find the whole rise of the security and surveillance state, the whole sort of stripping away of our civil liberties, which has been more egregious under the Obama administration than it was under the Bush administration, quite frightening, because when you give government this kind of power, certainly when government feels threatened or when there is any kind of civil unrest, they'll use it. I mean, history has shown that.
With the continuing incarceration of many suspected terrorists in Guantanamo and elsewhere under indefinite detention, along with the revelations from Edward Snowden about the NSA's massive dragnet surveillance programs and the erosion of civil liberty since 9/11, do you believe the American people are sufficiently aware of the dangers to our civil liberties now? And what course of action do you recommend for concerned citizens to take action to restore and protect their constitutional rights?
I don't think people are sufficiently aware. We have, especially on the electronic media, a kind of complete collapse of real journalism. You have cable shows like Fox, which essentially become mouthpieces of the right wing. MSNBC is a mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. But you didn't hear about it on MSNBC because it would have reflected poorly on Obama. You didn't hear about it on Fox because this has bipartisan support. But that was a window into how impoverished our journalism has become, that a case of this importance and this magnitude was not covered at all. I think since the Snowden revelations, it's been very hard for the government to mask the wholesale surveillance that they are carrying out.